From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, writer Scott Turow's latest mystery novel involves war crimes and the sometimes difficult task of telling the good guys from the bad guys.
I mean, look, if there's ever been a war fought in which all the right and good was on one side and all the wrong and evil was on the other, then I don't know what it is.
Later, astronomy contributor Gene Creighton talks about how to cope without Orion in the night sky.
And our full plate summer series continues with a Milwaukee writer's new book on food preservation.
I don't need you to know formulas to do the canning, but you just need to know what salt and sugar are doing in a chemical sense. And that's easy to understand, and it's also easier to understand when you're actually doing it. It becomes like a physical proof of concept.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The war in the former Yugoslav republics in the Balkans took place a quarter century ago, and while the atrocities perpetrated in those conflicts are known today, much about what transpired in Bosnia, Serbia, and elsewhere is still kind of shrouded in mystery.
The real-life mystery provides the backdrop for the mainly fictitious events that play out in writer Scott Turow's latest novel, Testimony, which revolves around an American prosecutor who goes to work for the International Criminal Court in The Hague to investigate the reported mass death of a group of Roma living in a Bosnian refugee camp a decade before.
Scott Turow, who is known for his novels such as Presumed Innocent and his law school memoir, 1L, will talk about the book this weekend in Milwaukee. But he joins us on the line from the Chicago area first. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Mitch. I'm glad to be with you.
I gather this story started for you with a real-life trip to the Netherlands. Is that right?
Yeah. I guess I was probably promoting a novel called Personal Injuries and ended up at a reception in The Hague. And for reasons that the novel, frankly, sets forth in detail, there are a lot of American lawyers in The Hague, and I found myself in a circle of them who worked at the International Criminal Tribunal there, and they were all going, you've got to write a book about this. You've got to write a book about this place, these cases, the back-channel diplomatic stuff, the personal relationships. All amazing.
Right. That was 17 years ago, which is a long time to have something sort of sitting out there in the hopper.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were other items on the list. I had been involved in capital litigation, so eventually I decided I wanted to write a novel about the death penalty, and then I wanted to write an essay, a nonfiction book about the death penalty. I had always wanted to try to come to peace with the aspects of my father that were best represented by his record and whereabouts in World War II, so I wrote a novel about that. But I've worked my way down the list till I got to the International Criminal Court in The Hague and the Roma, who have also been an object of great curiosity for decades.
Right. So when did your interest in the Roma first come about?
This is even further back. I had a relative dying while I was in law school, and I would visit him regularly when I was in town. And I came in one day, and the hospital was in tumult because in every waiting area there were encampments of people whom I recognized, and it was easier 45 years ago in the United States. I recognized them as gypsies or Roma. And I quickly divined that the leader of the Roma community, the so-called Gypsy King or Mauro Rome big man, was near death. And the hospital, as I said, they were upset because there were acts of petty theft taking place. Finally, I came in one day. The waiting rooms were empty. This was 45 years ago when you could still smoke in the hospital. And not only were the Roma all gone, but so were all of the ashtrays. And my response was an odd one, which was to say to myself, there is something about the value system of these people that I don't understand. Because most of us would say, I know I'm going to have to come back to the hospital someday, either for myself or a child. I don't want to make myself unwelcome in a place like a hospital. But clearly the Roma thinking didn't go that way. And I didn't know whether it was antagonism toward the majority, so that, you know, opportunity to take something than take it, or, you know, whether they were time-bound, or it was obviously a very different purchase on being in the world than what, you know, those of us raised in Western traditions would have.
Well, and it's interesting. One of the aspects of this book that's really pretty interesting is the nuances of how your protagonist, Bill Ten Boom, views the Roma, who have been through a lot over time, but he recognizes as the story plays out that it isn't as simple as there being good guys and bad guys when it comes to the Roma.
Yep, absolutely. And I don't want to pretend that there are not some very difficult cross-cultural issues, because there are. I don't think the majority is required. The majority culture is required to change its values to accommodate minority groups, so that, you know, because they have had such limited educational and employment opportunities, the level of criminality among the Roma in Europe is pretty high. They're the most imprisoned population in Europe. But you can't use that as an excuse to deprive them of education or employment either. So at least that's where my thinking ended up. And when you really become familiar with the history of oppression of the Roma people in Europe, it is staggering.
It's also interesting because the way the Roma are intertwined with the story seems almost like a microcosm of one of the major takeaways from this book, you know, without giving too much away, that especially when it comes to the Bosnian War, the idea of good guys and bad guys is kind of a false dichotomy as well.
I mean, look, if there's ever been a war fought in which all the right and good was on one side and all the wrong and evil was on the other, then I don't know what it is. Even if you take something that we classically think of as a war where the U.S. role was unambiguously good, which is, you know, World War II, it's still the case that there was inevitably a lot of conduct by the American troops in war that nobody would be putting in a training manual. And, you know, my dad came back with stories like that, and it's part of war. But, you know, war does not turn anyone into a nicer person, certainly not at the time.
What were the complexities? Because the Bosnian War was an especially complicated one. Was it a complex task even for someone who is, you know, used to plotting complex fiction, in taking the sort of real life framework of the Bosnian War and its aftermath and turning it into something that, you know, became a page turner?
There were two levels. The first was my own shock at myself, because I, of course, been a sentient adult from 1992 to 1995 when the Bosnian portion of the Balkan Wars were being fought. And I was astounded that, you know, as someone who was raised in a almost entirely Jewish neighborhood where the shadow of the Holocaust was never far away, that I had been so blind to what was happening in Bosnia. Ultimately, you know, for me as a novelist and a thriller writer, the significance of the Bosnian War was really the counterpoint between justice in the aftermath and trying to reestablish civilization, you know, the horrors of the war. And, you know, it's as if war is on one side and law is on the other. And as one of the characters says near the end of the book, you know, justice is good in and of itself, because no society can continue without a sense that wrongs are going to be made right, at least in the sense that they're going to be punished. So while sussing out the truth is no easy matter in the aftermath of a war, you know, the fact is that there were people like me who read the newspapers every day who didn't even know what was happening when it was going on, let alone a decade afterwards. But the moral complexities, at least for somebody like me who likes to write about those kinds of knotty ethical and moral problems, you know, you can't do much better. other than war and justice in the aftermath.
Well, and you created a fictional Serb leader who, you know, on his face is really kind of the epitome of evil. And I wonder how hard it was to write that character. And first of all, kind of get into the mind of someone like that. And at the same time, make him more than just a cartoon evil figure.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a chapter in the novel, In Testimony, without giving too much away, when this monster of history, a leader of the Bosnian Serb community, is confronted by the narrator, the lawyer Bill Tenbrun. And there was just one of those scenes that when I sat down to write it, it seemed like I'd been prepared to write it for many years. And I think at some level, as both a prosecutor and a defense lawyer, I have spent lot of time wondering how people who are responsible for really mass crime can possibly explain this to themselves. Certainly, it was not hard writing, and I know many readers have told me that it's a pretty gripping scene, and it was certainly, I had the sense as I was writing it that it certainly had a kind of dramatic gravity, and it felt like kind of accuracy, at least within the framework of a novel.
Well, I will say, if you can read that scene without your blood pressure increasing substantially, there's probably something wrong with you.
Well, I don't like to say it was fun to write. Subjects under discussion are not terribly entertaining, but the fact that this character was emerging with his own unapologetic point of view was something that I thought was, as I say, accurate, at least within the rules of the novel. As it happens, I've heard from Radovan Karadzic's lawyer, Peter Robinson, and he thought it was pretty good, too. And I got another letter last week from another of the lawyers at one of the international criminal tribunals in The Hague, and he said you nailed it. So I guess my research paid off.
Well, and at some level, this is why you're a writer, to try to figure these guys out.
I think that's a really astute observation, and that at least for somebody like me, who's always fascinated in this intersection of the personal and the legal and the moral. You're right. One of the things that keeps me writing, as well as reading, but writing in particular, is to figure out what the internal life is like of someone like, you know, the character who in Testimony is called Lazakayevich.
So you've done a number of onstage conversations about Testimony in recent weeks. I'm just curious whether there have been any surprises in what you've heard from people, what they have taken from this book.
One of the things that's interesting to me is that I'm very happy I wrote this book. It embraces a lot of different themes, you know, international justice and war crime, certainly, you know, middle-aged angst and the plight of the Roma. And, you know, to me, it's a coherent whole. But that means there are a lot of different things in the novel that people can react to, and so at times I'm asked about the character's sex lives. At times I'm asked about questions like the one you were asking about, you know, coming to terms with really great evil. And I've heard from the Dutch community, because the novel is set for the most part in The Hague, in the Netherlands. And I guess I'm really, one of the things that's pleased me the most is the diversity of the responses, ranging from even reviews who say, USA Today said this is a great book for your beach bag, whereas, you know, the New York Times reviewed it as, you know, what they called an important and admirable novel. And I've always wanted to be able to sort of hit the water level that's right for each individual reader. And there's something about Testimony that does seem to provoke that diversity of responses.
Well, I am very much looking forward to continuing our conversation this weekend, but let me just say, Scott Turow, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Writer Scott Turow's latest novel is called Testimony. He'll talk about it at a Boswell Book Company event that Mitch will moderate at the Samson Jewish Community Center in Whitefish Bay on Sunday. You can find a link to more information from WUWM.com. Well, before you go to that, though, you should call 414-227-3210 or go to that website, WUWM.com, and make a contribution to help us reach our goal this hour of $800 and to keep interviews like the one Mitch is doing with Scott on the air.
Right, exactly. And book interviews, whether they're fiction or nonfiction or sometimes kind of a hybrid in ways, they're one of the staples of Lake Effect. They have been since we debuted Lake Effect, you know, almost 11 years ago at this point. And, you know, we know they resonate with people. We have an audience that reads a lot. And one of the things that's great to do is to be able to expose people to books they might or might not have read. As we say, you know, it's important to keep this show healthy and with us for years to come. So why not take just a couple moments to call 414-227-3210. And when you make a donation of $5 or more today, you'll receive a gift certificate good for a free single scoop ice cream cone from Purple Door Ice Cream. A pretty sweet reward.
That is a very sweet reward. I can think of about three different flavors that I could have right now.
Some of the most interesting flavors in the city come out of Purple Door Ice Cream. In fact, I should mention, you know, we once did a book interview on site at Purple Door Ice Cream. So it all comes together.
It all ties together very, very nicely. The phone number is 414-227-3210 or go to the website WUWM.com and help us raise the $800 we need for this hour.
And thanks so much. I hate to interrupt your thanks.
That's okay. Coming up after a break, though, our Full Plate series on agriculture continues with a conversation about how to preserve your garden's bounty. We'll chat with Milwaukee County's Master Food Preserver when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
A peddler once was driving by. His cart with fruit was laden high. And as he drove along, he cried across the village green.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. All summer, Lake Effect is exploring agriculture in southeastern Wisconsin in a series we call Full Plate. Our definition of agriculture is wide. We're talking about everything from backyard gardens to humanely raised and slaughtered meat, from which consumers are buying what kind of produce, to the migrant workers who harvest our food.
Today, we're talking with Christina Ward about home food preservation, from canning to fermenting to dehydrating. Christina is an expert teaching Milwaukeeans how to put food by. Her new book is called Aptly Enough Preservation, and she says that among the many professional hats she wears, there is one that she is particularly proud of.
I'm a master food preserver for Milwaukee County. I had a fight with the state to get the accreditation because they didn't believe that a city, an urban area, needed this old rural program of teaching people the safest way to preserve food. But as we all know, is Milwaukee's on the cutting edge of the urban agriculture movement. And so with all the folks with guerrilla gardens, with the victory gardens, with all the garden plots that we have around the city, you're going to grow a lot of stuff and you need to figure out how you're going to extend the life of it. And so preservation, it's something I grew up doing and I'm really interested in. So I've been teaching it in coordination with the University of Wisconsin, the Extension Office. That's who's the authorizing body. So I'm the master food preserver, which means I'm a volunteer in my community charged with giving people the latest and greatest science.
Wow, I didn't even know that that was like a state job.
It's a volunteer job, and it's kind of cool, the history of it, because it comes from that post-Civil War era of the westward expansion and the idea of an old land-grant university. And so people may be more familiar with the Master Gardener program, and again, that's through the extension. The idea is it's an extension of the university, that a university like Madison is taxpayer, has some taxpayer support, and what the university gives back is knowledge. And the extension programs are about that outreach, about sharing that knowledge. And so when you talk about for Master Food Preserver program, for example, at Wisconsin, they do a lot of the microbiological testing, equipment testing, And then they share that information throughout the country and then with other master food preservers around the country to make sure that, the science that they did gets out to the people.
So talk a little bit about the accreditation that you had to do to get this, which then, of course, led you to write this very extensive book about the preservation of food.
So the studying I had to do was, again, it's an interesting program in the sense that to become a part of it, you have to prove knowledge. So you come in having to have a practical applied knowledge. You have to know how to do it already. And then the university does the further testing and education. So I had to actually take like a written exam. I had to do practicals, which is they give you a recipe and you had to make it correctly with Dr. Barbara Ingram. And she's looking over your shoulder, making sure you're doing it absolutely correctly. And she will absolutely tell you if it's wrong. And so going through that process, you know, gives you that structure and gives you access to the newest information, which, again, we tried to share with everybody. And it teaching, I love teaching. I love sharing for information. I'm a firm believer that information is something that wants to be out there. I'm not a fan of kind of that. There's sometimes in food culture you see it with hoarding of information that somebody knows how to do something and they're the only person that knows how to do it. I'm the opposite. So I partnered early on with the Milwaukee Public Schools, with the Recreation Department, to be able to teach food preservation in all its forms.
And that's in the first part of the book, you describe going into the kitchen, which basically was a stove and a sink.
Yes. Yeah. There's lots of kitchens, the old home ec kitchens throughout Milwaukee Public Schools and the rec centers. I've been in some fancy kitchens and I've been in the middle of a field. With some of the bare requirements like running water or some heat, you can preserve food. And so the idea was to take it down, keep it where it was, where it started, food preservation started, which was a practical skill that you needed to do to stay alive. And not a gourmet thing. Now, it's fun to do the gourmet stuff and to make things taste really good and do a little experimentation. But at its core, this is a practical life skill that has use today in modernity.
Yeah, it's a practical life skill. It's also a science-based skill because you have to understand, you know, how microbes work, and you have to understand what heat does to things and what pickling does and all of those chemical processes as well.
And that was really the motivation for writing the book because, one, there's so much of the high-level science out there, and I digested that going through, you know, the Master Food Preserver Training Program as well as my own research. And then there's the kind of folklore. And between the two, it can be difficult to understand and scary sometimes. And so I think that my idea, it's how I teach people, is to take the science, make those concepts relatively easy to understand. So I don't need you to know formulas to do the canning, but you just need to know what salt and sugar are doing in a chemical sense. And that's easy to understand. And it's also easier to understand when you're actually doing it. It becomes like a physical proof of concept. You get to say, oh, I see the jelly gelling. I know why now. And it also gives you confidence when you're doing it.
Well, I think one of the things for those of us who grew up with mothers and grandmothers who canned all summer long, you know, as things were coming out of the garden, I can remember my mother standing over big hot things, you know, the boiling water for the jars and all of that. I think some of the fear of people who didn't do it themselves is that I'm going to have something explode in my pantry because it's got botulism.
That is a legitimate fear, and that's what we talk about. We're food preservation a little different than actual cooking. If you cook something poorly, you'll burn it. You can't eat it. If you can something poorly, one, you may not know you did it incorrectly if you don't understand what you're doing in the first place. And then the larger ramifications are something like botulism, which you can't see, you can't taste, you can't smell. So doing things correctly, understanding the science behind it and following the correct procedures helps you then prevent that from ever happening. Cases of botulism due to canning, food preservation are always, always, always because someone did it wrong. And they did it wrong because they either chose to ignore or just didn't understand the science behind it.
Take me through a basic, simple canning process. You know, let's pick something that's fresh right now. What's growing right now?
The strawberries are almost ready.
Okay.
Almost
ready. So we're going to make strawberry jam, you and me. How do I start?
So first of all, wash. That's the first thing. Wash your hands, wash your berries, wash everything. And then, believe it or not, take the greens off. I had one heartbreaking call of somebody, you know, oh, my jam, my strawberry jam turned brown, and we troubleshoot, walk through it, and the poor lady, she didn't take the green stems off. Take the stems off. Take the green hulls out. So it's a very simple thing. It's a ratio. So you're to make a basic strawberry jam, 4 cups of berries, a little bit of lemon juice, which acts as a catalyst. There's your chemical term, to help break apart all of the cell walls, and that's your heat. You're going to put that into a pot with equal 4 cups of sugar. Yep, that's a lot. And it's not for sweetening. It's doing a job because sugar absorbs water. So again, any type of food preservation is really about erecting barriers against the microbes. It's a race. Who's going to eat the food first, you or the microbes? So sugar takes away water. Microbes need water. And so that essentially extends the life of that food, that strawberry jam. You cook it all up. The other thing that you can do is you cook it to a point where it becomes thick. That's through evaporation. Again, it's losing its water. Thanks to modern science, we have pectin you can add in. Pectin is a natural fiber. It's the thing that keeps the skin of the fruit together. Fruits that have thick skins have more pectin. Fruits that have thin skins don't have as much. So again, adding a pectin, you bring it up to a boil. It sets, it's jam. So you've got strawberry jam. You could stick it in the fridge and have it last a few weeks. You could put it in the freezer and have it last a few months. Or you could take the next step. You put it in jars and you put it in a hot water boiling canner. And all that means is it's submerged for a prescribed length of time. And after that, it creates, that's the physics of canning. It pushes all the available oxygen out, creates a hermetic seal. Nothing can get in. And there you go. You're 1 year, 1 year to 18 months on your pantry shelf. That's it.
But you have to also sterilize those jars.
Well, sterilization is an interesting kind of term. So when we think about sterilization, we are thinking about grandmothers, you know, and boiling all the jars. What you forget sometimes, again, this is where we have the extension and the universities doing this research, is science marches forward. Hot, soapy water. Hot, soapy water is great. So you don't have to boil your jars. If you wash them in hot, soapy water and rinse them right before you're going to use them, that's great. If you have a dishwasher, even better. Load them up, run the dishwasher cycle, leave them in there hot until you need them. Much easier.
Food preservation has been around as long as human beings have been around. And you talk about that with fermentation and dehydration, because those are two other ways of preserving food that you touch on.
All preservation is really about extension, extending the life of the food and erecting barriers against germs, against microbes. Fermentation, really interesting, because essentially you're bacterial farming. What you're doing is attracting good bacteria, good microbes that then drive out the bad ones. Again, when I'm talking to kids about food preservation, the thing to keep in mind is bacteria poop is acid. Yeast poop is alcohol. So if you're making beer or wine, that's where you're, the byproduct,
it's
that's
a
alcohol.
Great image. Yeah.
So mm-hmm. And so really what we're doing is we're using fermentation is using attracting bacteria to create acid, to create a high acid environment. Again, microbes are symbiotic to humans. They want the same things we want. So when we create a high acid environment, either through fermentation or pickling, what we're doing is we're making the place not a happy home for germs, for microbes.
Right. And a happy place for the ones that work in our
exactly.
systems
mm-hmm.
and feed our own biome.
Right. And that's where kombucha is interesting, because kombucha is then essentially it's both an acid and an alcohol, because it's the SCOBY. You hear the term SCOBY. That's both a bacterial and a yeast. And so to come back to this, is people have been doing this for time immemorial, since we started eating. The question that food scientists and food historians really haven't figured out yet is, why did someone start eating it? It's easy to understand how something got left out. You know, Krog, you know, the caveman pot left the fish too long and it started to go bad, i.e. ferment. But who decided to eat it? The same thing with something really dried out. So starvation, hunger plays a huge role in food history of how we decided to start eating things. And then who decided it was good? There are many foods all around the world that are definitely an acquired taste.
Right. And I'm also thinking of putting things together for a long winter, because here in Wisconsin, we have a long time where things aren't growing and we have to be able to save food. Like you say, extend the life of things. I grew up in New Hampshire, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have the dried meats, you have the preserved vegetables, preserved fruits, and, you know, alcohols if you're making beer or cider that is in the fall when you do the apples. So do you think that that is a large part of this, as well as that we were trying to hold on to things?
That is a huge part of it. It also, that discovery, you know, again, thousands and thousands of years ago, of something could be dried, something could be fermented, and then taken with you, was, you know, played a huge role in kind of the exploration age of the world. And that also goes to how people could then live in really harsh climates. Once they figured out, say, you know, Scandinavian countries are a really good example. They have a huge amount of both dried foods and fermented foods. Once they figured that out, how to do that, and that they like to eat that, that enabled them to live in climates that did not have a year-round growing season, just like us hardy folks in Wisconsin and from New Hampshire.
Yes, who have Scandinavian backgrounds.
So again, how and why we eat food and how we prepare it. And so this idea, this it's a very modern notion that you can go into a grocery store and buy an apple any day of the year. That is a wholly modern invention. I mean, modern meaning 20th century, really. The idea of refrigerated storage, refrigerated transport, bringing food in from other countries.
Right. And really like mid-20th century.
Mid-20th century, yeah. Until then, if you couldn't grow it or get it in your own very close vicinity and then preserve it, you were out of luck. There are many stories. There's the great Wisconsin historical book called Wisconsin Death Trips, Michael Lazy, 1973. I'm always fond of it because it talks about the area where my grandmother's farm was, in that Osseo, Jackson County, Black River. And so you hear, using newspaper clippings and actual anecdotes, you hear these stories of people surviving the winter, and a lot of times not surviving the winter, whether they go cabin fever stir crazy or run out of food. It was a real thing that happened to people. And so that skill of preserving food was a critical life skill.
So here we are in 2017. People seem to be interested in acquiring that skill again. What do you think is behind the interest? It seems more and more people want to know how to do this.
I think there's a number of reasons people come to food preservation, which to me is always really interesting. So you see a bunch of people who come to, and I'm basing this based on who comes to classes. So there's folks that are wanting to reconnect to their own food history. That's something maybe their grandmother did, they remember seeing, but they themselves never learned how to do it. So they want to reconnect to their personal food history. There's also more awareness about the chemical preservation, the chemicals that go into processed foods, and people are trying to remove those from their lives. So going back to an old way, this way of food preservation reduces the amount of chemicals that you would need, i.e. none. And so there's folks that do that. There's also people that want to preserve food based on some dietary necessities. So there are so many things like gluten that are just added to everything. So by preserving it yourself, you have a 100% total control over what you're eating. And then there's the economic reasons. If you're growing your own food and then able to preserve your food, you have high quality food, say in the winter or any time of year, that you have 100% control over, and some, you know, it gives you some economic stability.
Are you seeing people from all walks of life interested in this, different ages, different ethnicities?
Absolutely. And that's, to me, that's the best part of the Milwaukee recreation classes. We keep them cheap and cheerful. I always say working classes for the working classes. The idea is you're coming in, you're making stuff, you're learning it, you're taking some things home. And the folks that are coming to those classes, because they are affordable, are everybody from, you know, grandmas trying to relearn the right way, updating the science, to we've had teenage girls who are going to start their business their next day after they know how to do it, and from all parts of the city of Milwaukee. My favorite part is when you're talking about food, food's always the equalizer among everybody. I don't care your political background or whatever your ideologies are. When people are talking about food, they're happy, and people love talking about their favorite foods and their favorite food memories, and, you know, what they're going to make and what they're going to eat, and exchanging ideas about what someone else is doing and trying it themselves. That's the best part.
Well, Christina, it is such a pleasure to see you again, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
It is called Preservation, the Art and Science of Canning, Fermentation, and Dehydration, and we are so pleased you were able to come in.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Christina Ward is the master food preserver for Milwaukee County and author of the new book, Preservation, the Art and Science of Canning, Fermentation, and Dehydration. She'll be at Boswell Book Company tomorrow night at 7 to talk about the book and to answer questions about the right way to extend the life of your garden's bounty. This is a pretty obvious transition here, Bonnie, but the right way to extend the life of this radio station's bounty is by taking part in our summer membership drive, 414-227-3210, or visit us at wuwm.com/give and preserve this station for another year.
Exactly. This is a perfect time to help us stay well, stay healthy, and to keep all of these book interviews and all the interviews that you hear on Lake Effect and all the other shows that you hear on Milwaukee Public Radio coming to you without interruption. It is just a terrific thing. We have $800 to raise this hour, and we have a little sweet reward, don't we?
In fact, you know, we should mention that part of the agriculture series coming up a little later in the week, Friday, in fact, is a conversation about dairy desserts. And appropriately enough, when you make a contribution of $5 or more today, you'll receive a certificate good for a Fringle, a free single scoop ice cream. We like to call it a Fringle. Free single scoop ice cream cone from Purple Door Ice Cream that's in Walker's Point. You can get it in a sugar cone or a cup. It is extra if you want any toppings like Jimmy's, additional scoops, or a substitute for a waffle cone. And from what I gather, you cannot give $20 and get one of those tasting flights. I don't think that counts.
Oh, too bad. But, yeah, that would be nice.
But still, a pretty sweet
nice
deal,
exactly.
In fact. $5 or more gets you that certificate. Good for a free single scoop ice cream cone from Purple Door. And, you know, Bonnie, you and I are both from New England, where we take our ice cream seriously.
Very, very seriously. I know Wisconsinites like to think that they take dairy seriously, but so do we.
Exactly.
So do we. So very quickly, 414-227-3210 is the number to call. Help us raise that $800 for this hour.
And, you know, I'd like to point out that it is not limited to that ice cream cone. When you make a contribution of $10 a month or more, you can also take advantage of the Public Radio Nerd T-shirt. It says Public Radio Nerd on it. It has the WUWM and NPR logos. And I hear tell it is a perfect T-shirt to wear when you go out and get ice cream.
There you go. It's a win-win.
414-227-3210, wuwm.com/give.
We will take one last break and then learn what's visible in the night sky in late June. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM right after this.
Stars shining bright above you. Night breezes seem to
whisper. We're back with more of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. This summer, the Northern Hemisphere sees some pretty spectacular astronomical events. The Perseid meteor showers will peak in mid-August, and about a week after that, parts of the U.S. will witness the first total solar eclipse visible here since 1979. It is also the first one visible from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic since 1918.
Lake Effect's astronomy contributor Gene Creighton will talk about the eclipse with us next month, but until then, there are still many wonderful things to observe in the night sky. Hello, Gene. It is great to see you.
Hi, Bonnie.
And it's finally warm enough to be outside looking at the sky at night. It's my favorite time of year because I finally feel like I can get out there and not have to, like, wrap up and everything. But I'm feeling a little lost. And you know why?
Why?
Because I don't see Orion.
It's confusing, isn't it?
It is, because Orion is kind of like my signpost.
Mm-hmm.
And is that true for a lot of people?
It is. Even my staff, I think, feel a little discombobulated because around Orion, there's so many really bright stars. And when Orion sets, it's a bit underwhelming. There are a lot of much dimmer things in the sky. I, on the other hand, quite honestly, feel a sense of relief. When Orion is below the horizon, I feel like finally the weather now has improved.
Okay, so for you, it's the harbinger of summer.
That's right.
Okay.
I'm very happy to see Orion. I mean, I like Orion, don't get me wrong. It's a beautiful thing. But when the time comes, I'm glad that it's gone.
Okay.
Yeah.
But for those of us who kind of look at Orion as something where we can hang our astronomical hats, mm-hmm. as it were, what do we do when he's not there?
Okay. So here's the deal. When Orion is below the horizon, you have the Big Dipper to hold on to. And most people can find the Big Dipper. Of course, it's the shopping cart with the long, curvy handle. The nice thing about this time of year is that in the early, relatively early evening, the Big Dipper is very high. For some, a good portion of the year, the Big Dipper is very low on the northern horizon, tricky to spot sometimes. And if you have a building or something, you might not even be able to see it at all. But now it's way high, which means you get the North Star as always, but you also get two really bright stars. The two bright stars you get are Arcturus and Spica.
And I remember this.
Yay.
Arc to Arcturus.
Yes.
And Spica.
Yay! Awesome. So if you get those two bright stars, you have two constellations for free, and I think they're both interesting constellations and not run-of-the-mill. So you can impress your friends. You can be impressed yourself, in fact. Arcturus is the brightest star in the constellation of Bootes. So it looks weird. It's Bootes. And you might be tempted to say Bootes, but it is Bootes. And that's the cow herder. But I say it looks like an ice cream cone, which seems to be very appropriate for summertime. So if you imagine that Arcturus is at the tip of the cone, it has a cone and there's a blob of ice cream. So that would be Bootes. How that becomes a cow herder, I couldn't tell you.
They didn't have ice cream then. Maybe
that's... that's true. Yeah, I guess they didn't have a better way of describing it. Yeah. And Spica is the brightest star in Virgo, who's supposed to be a young woman. And I look for a squished box, or if you like to think of it in geometric terms, it looks like a trapezium. So those two bright stars are a very nice anchor. The arc to Arcturus and Spica this time of year, I mean this year, might lead you a little astray because you might arc to Arcturus and spy Jupiter, because in that direction, the brightest thing you're going to see is not Spica. The brightest thing you're going to see is Jupiter.
That's cool.
Yes, the biggest planet in our solar system, which even with a pair of binoculars, you can see the four Galilean moons, the four moons that Galileo saw. Okay, maybe binoculars, that's a little optimistic. You'd have to have a dark sky to do that. But with a modest telescope, you should be able to see four little dots around Jupiter, and you can make one of the discoveries for yourself that Galileo made that made him think, you know what, the Earth can't be in the center of everything because I have proof that there's something that's going around Jupiter and not the Earth. So you can connect to the big thoughts, the big experiments that the world has had.
You know, when you think about that, I mean, we know this. We grew up with that information. We know that the Earth is not the center of pretty much anything,
right,
astronomically. But at that point, I always like to try to think of what that was like to discover that, to realize, wait a minute, my entire worldview is wrong.
Right.
And I have to rethink how I see myself and the world that I live on. And, you know, I don't know if we've had anything quite like that. Maybe
going to the moon.
Going to the moon and those pictures looking back at Earth,
mm-hmm.
you know, as that blue dot mm-hmm. in that black void. And you think, oh, wait, wow. But it's built on what Galileo must have felt, the same sort of like both discombobulation and elation.
I wonder if Galileo already had bought in the idea and now was just thrilled that he found some evidence to support what he already thought. But you're right. The moment that you make that kind of discovery, it would be like for us finding life or some technological, it would shift the ground that we're standing on. It would make us think differently about everything, I think. I think if you make that kind of discovery, it must unsettle you a little bit. It must make you kind of think, whoa, I discovered something big and I'm really excited, but I'm kind of frightened too.
Yeah, I'm a little dizzy.
Yeah, I'm a little dizzy.
It kind of makes your brain go, wait a minute, and you can understand how people retreat back to the things that they know,
mm-hmm.
because that's really terrifying mm-hmm. to rethink that.
Yeah.
But most of the time when I'm looking at the night sky, I'm not expecting to change the world.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I don't think I ever will in that sense. But it's still wonderful sometimes to look up there and realize that you're seeing very similar things that Galileo saw.
Yes.
And
if
and,
not the Babylonians, right?
If not the Babylonians, and maybe even more primitive peoples were looking up and thinking, huh, what are those things?
Right.
And how do we fit into this?
Right.
It's so cool.
Yeah. The other pattern, I think, not to bring you back to stars,
okay,
but
that's
I guess
bring us back to stars.
But I do think it's an easy, it's a gimme. In the east, in the northeast, we're going to be able to see the Northern Crown. And I don't think, even when I was a PhD student, I don't think I knew about the Northern Crown, or I certainly didn't think about it. But when I work with audiences, I see that it's one of those things that people can find because it's highly symmetrical. We're looking for the letter C, and depending on where you're facing, it might be upside down or inside out, but it's very symmetrical. Looks like the letter C or a half crown. And I think it's something that people can find.
Okay. So
fairly easily.
This is the Northern Crown. So that's the giveaway. It's,
yep.
It's
that's
in
the gimme.
North.
Yep.
Yep. Low to the horizon?
Well, it's going to move through the night sky.
Okay.
So depending on what time you go to bed, it can be in the east. But sometimes, well, I mean, if you go to bed later, it's going to be high in the sky. And it points to, of course, the superhero Hercules, which is nice to know. Hercules looks a bit like a kite, but I don't think you can find the kite of Hercules because there are all kinds of kites unless you have the Northern Crown to guide you. So with that, I'll add one more just before it gets super dark. You'll still be able to find Gemini, the twins, in the west. I like Gemini because the two top stars, they're bright enough you can see them by the bus stop under the lamp. Really, really bright. So we'll be able to see those just enough in the west right around sunset.
Well, lots of things to look for.
Yeah.
And who knows? Maybe there will be an earth-changing or worldview-changing discovery at some point. But I think just looking
is amazing enough.
Is amazing enough.
Yeah.
So, well, enjoy, Gene. I know it's one of the things you love to do, and I will be out there as well. We'll talk to you next month.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Gene Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium on the campus of UW-Milwaukee, and she is our regular astronomy contributor.
Finally today, a chance to revisit a Lake Effect studio session. We spoke a couple of years ago with Laura and Lydia Rogers, the duo known as the Secret Sisters. The two write contemporary original songs that sound both fresh and retro, hearkening back to the formative years of country and swing.
They have a new album just out and will play Tuesday evening at the Colectivo back room, but here they are in the Lake Effect performance studio back in 2014 performing a song of murder and mayhem called Ayuka.
I'd never tell a man to ask my daddy for my hand. I've got a thousand tales about the temper of that man. He'd shoot a man who came within a mile of my young frame. But I know that you will take the risk so I can take your name. You've got the ring, I've got the keys, and 60 miles ahead, Ayuka, Mississippi, where the two of us will wed. Take me down to Ayuka, Mississippi, for he knows the two of us have up and gone. Take me down to Ayuka, Mississippi, we can run away and never come home, never come home. My daddy finally knocked a little sense right into me. So I asked around until I found a justice of the peace. The bruises on my body can't be hidden anymore. So park your car up on the hill, I'm headed out the door. Step easy.
crazy so my daddy doesn't hear us sneak away. Hang around, he'll shoot you down, that's why we just can't stay. Take me down to Iuka, Mississippi, before he knows the two of us have up and gone. Take me down to Iuka, Mississippi, we can run away and never come home. Follow close behind me, not much further now. Oh, it's just a shadow, I didn't hear a sound. Ain't no way he heard us, ain't no way he'll come. I hear someone breathing, hold my hand and run. Somewhere in the river there's a gun the devil owns. Somehow everybody knew that everything was wrong. A noose up in the maple tree, the old man's gonna pay. Two headstones for two lovers who finally got away. Take me down to Iuka, Mississippi, before he knows the two of us have up and gone. Take me down to Iuka, Mississippi, we can run away and never come home. Take me down to Iuka, Mississippi, for he knows the two of us have up and gone. Take me down to Iuka, Mississippi, we can run away and never come home. Never come home. Never come.
The Secret Sisters, Laura and Lydia Rogers, performing Iuka in the Lake Effect Studio back in 2014. The new album is called You Don't Own Me Anymore, and they'll play Tuesday evening at the Collectivo Back Room.
We have just a few more seconds to remind you that we are working towards an $800 hourly goal. And when you make a contribution during our summer membership drive to 414-227-3210 or wuwm.com/give, you are supporting all the things that you love about Lake Effect. The studio sessions, the interviews with authors, our interviews that keep you in the dark, at least when it comes to astronomy, and much more. Won't you take just a few minutes out and call 414-227-3210 or
WUWM.com. And that is the Thursday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
It is 11 o'clock, and fresh air comes your way next. Stay tuned.